From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Proportional representation. Grassroots activists have a measure on the San Francisco ballot for preferential voting.
When people feel that a system is more fair, then they are more apt to get out and vote. When people feel that the system is not fair because their candidates are not able to really run or you know, they're not the ones they want to run, their candidates don't win, that, you know, creates and encourages voter apathy and cynicism.
Gays and lesbians get out the vote for President Clinton and the politics of alternative medicine. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, it's unbelievable but true. Indonesia and East Timor seem to be becoming a presidential campaign issue. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole demanded yesterday that President Clinton answer questions about his links to Indonesian businessmen and their contributions to Democratic Party coffers. Clinton's ties to Indonesian James Riady, close to the Suharto dictatorship of Indonesia, have been fiercely attacked by Republicans in recent days, who suspect Riady's influence is behind big contributions to the Democratic Party from individuals with links to an Indonesian financial conglomerate known as the Lippo Group. Among those they have contributed to are Webster Hubbell, who was disgraced and had to resign from the Justice Department as its number two man. Dole was speaking to reporters outside of his plane in Kansas City, so listen carefully.
There are a whole lot of problems here that have been raised. Taking money from a foreign nation, and then they gave it back when somebody caught them. But why did they do it? Why did he meet with these people? What did it have any impact on the policies in East Timor? And a lot of other questions I think ought to be raised. And we're going to raise the questions every day until the president properly responds. Not some slip, slide, and duck, Mr. President, but just answer the questions and tell us what you did and what the administration did and why they did it.
Did you hear that? Dole said, did it have any impact on the policies in East Timor? Although we do have to add that Dole, as Senate Majority Leader, has scuttled any legislation that would help the people of East Timor, occupied by Indonesia for the last 21 years. House Speaker Newt Gingrich said on Sunday, investigations are unavoidable into an Indonesian couple's $425,000 contribution to the Democratic Party. The man who made that contribution, his job was listed as a landscaper.
It's unavoidable that that there will be congressional investigations. It's unavoidable that there will be a special counsel. This makes this makes Watergate look tiny. I mean, this is a potential abuse of the American system on behalf of an Indonesian billionaire in a way that we have never seen in American history.
Even Democrats are concerned. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold, who is a leader in the Senate on the issue of East Timor, was questioned on CNN as to whether he supported Senator John McCain's calls for a special prosecutor.
I do think that this should be looked at very closely, and there's no excuse for violation of our laws with regard to foreign contributions or with regard to domestic contributions.
Vice President Gore, though, insists nothing's wrong.
We have abided by every single law, every single regulation. There have been no violations. There have been no charges to the contrary, unlike in the case with the Dole campaign, incidentally. So we will continue to abide strictly by the law.
All this news happens to come out just a few days after the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize on Friday to two Timorese, José Ramos Horta and Bishop Bello. And other news, Archer Daniels Midland Corporation said yesterday it has agreed to pay $100 million, the largest criminal antitrust fine in history, to the U.S. Treasury, and to plead guilty to fixing the prices of two little-known ingredients that are widely used in modern food production. Let's not forget that Archer Daniels Midland not only sponsors all the political talk shows on television, or at least a good majority of them, but also the Democratic and Republican parties. And you're listening to Democracy Now! In 1992, health care reform was one of the major issues in the presidential election. In 1996, you barely hear a mention of it. In fact, the only presidential candidates who have been talking seriously about health care reform are third-party candidates like the Green Party's Ralph Nader, who calls for a single-payer system, and John Hagelin of the Natural Law Party, who questions the disease care model in this country that emphasizes high-tech intervention instead of preventative medicine. As more Americans experience the limitations of our healthcare system, more and more people are turning to alternative therapies, most of which are not covered by health insurance. We now turn to Burton Goldberg, who's the leading force behind a new book, more than 1,000 pages, called Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide.
23 years ago, my friend's daughter, in a fit of depression at the age of 19, attempted suicide. Frankly, she was being talked to death by a psychiatrist. When a holistic physician in California discovered she was hypoglycemic, a blood sugar imbalance, and when he treated her simply with diet and nutrients, this young girl got over anxiety, depression, and schizophrenia. I was amazed. I was a builder-developer, had no knowledge of medicine. So I start looking around, and I saw that there was a whole field that was being suppressed by mainstream medicine on cancer, heart disease, you just name it. And I started studying. I went to Europe and went to Germany and England and France and Russia and China even. And I discovered the doctors who were successfully reversing these supposedly impossible conditions. And I realized that the American government was spending $2 billion a year on cancer and $5 billion on AIDS research and going nowhere. And it was alternative medicine who has answers to these situations that reverse them. They're inexpensive. And we also know what causes these problems. Like mainstream medicine doesn't understand that the pesticides and herbicides that are legislated in Washington can very much affect how much cancer we have. Female breast cancer today in the United States is 1 out of 8 women. It's escalating at the rate of 1.3% a year. Now, these are medical journals. In 1950, it was 1 in 20 with females would have breast cancer. In 1900, 1 in 33 would have all kinds of cancer. So you see, it's escalating. It's beyond 1 in 3 going to 1 in 2. And no one's talking about it. Not one of the government officials are out there and departments are telling you that pesticides and herbicides are the reason for this holocaust of degenerative disease and particularly cancer and cancer of the breast.
But Burton Goldberg, many would say that really cancer is mainly a disease of old age. And what you're seeing when you compare figures from 1996 to 1900 is simply a population that's actually healthier and living longer. And that's why you see more cancer.
That's nonsense. Total nonsense. Let me give you an example. The year 1973, Hadassah Medical School discovers the relationship between female breast cancer and pesticides and herbicides. And they then do a study. There's an outcry, and they do a 10-year study. The government forbids the use of pesticides and herbicides in the feed of milk cows and cattle. Nothing else. Cigarette smoking, alcohol, everything stays the same in Israel. They then do a study from 1976 to 1986. The female breast cancer rate in women under 44 plummets 34%. The overall breast cancer rate for all ages drops 8%, while we in the United States go up 4%. Now, we have an epidemic, and we know it's true. Now, let me give you further proof. Hildegard Sacarel is a toxicologist in northern Florida. She goes to a naval hospital where the surgeon removes this older sailor's prostate. And anyone who has cancer or is thinking of an operation pays strict attention to this. They then do what's called a split biopsy. Half the pathology, it's cancerous. The other half the toxicology. Inside the tumor, they find arsenic, chlordane, and DDT. And DDT's been banned in this country for 30 years. But as we manufacture it and send it down to Central and South America, and they spray the food and the coffee, and it comes back to us microbit by microbit. We are being silently poisoned to death, and the purpose of alternative medicine is to say, wake up, America, you're being poisoned to death, become political, and make sure that your congressmen, senators see that we have clean air, clean food, and clean water. If not, you too are going to be a statistic.
Now, in the book, Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide, you not only talk about causes of problems, but you talk about therapies once you have these problems. Can you talk about some of these therapies that if people go to conventional MDs, conventional doctors, they never hear about even words like homeopathy?
Absolutely not. Homeopathics are inexpensive and unpatented, and they're not taught that in medical schools. And for the first time, the entire school of alternative medicine is put under the roof of one book, the covers of my book called Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide. We explain homeopathy. We explain herbals. We explain aromatherapy to reduce stress. These inexpensive, non-toxic, non-patentable substances compete with the pharmaceutical industry. And those wonderful people who have brought you drugs that are 130% higher from the 1980 to 1990. We can go to Mexico and buy the identical package for 3 to 5 times less. So you have a greed factor here. They don't want you to know that you can cure headaches with bicarb soda. Instead, they want you to take Tylenol and aspirin and all the other things that have side effects.
Oh, wait a second. As a headache sufferer myself, you have to talk a little more about some of these solutions.
Well, let me give you an example. I do a lot of traveling, and I came across a young lady, 25 years old. She says, I've had migraines since the age of 9. I opened your book, and Robert Milne, an MD from Las Vegas, Nevada, says, try bicarbonate of soda. If it removes your migraine or your headache, look to allergy as the cause. She did, and then she reported for the first time, she'd been to 20 doctors, her migraines disappeared. And then 3 months later, she reported to me that chocolate was her culprit. So the bones out of the place in the head may cause it, or in the spine. You see, the difference between mainstream medicine and alternative medicine is go to the root cause. Find the cause, you can find the cure.
I was interested to see you also have a chapter here on children's health. How are kids dealt with any differently from adults, or are they?
They're not really, but you're going to the cause. Rather than get, for instance, most children have infections of the ear. Now, our alternative doctors will use homeopathy, inexpensive, and they'll be on a course of antibiotics for week after week, and the pain persists. They can't fall asleep. They're screaming, and the doctors want to put grommets, tubes in the ear. But Dr. Whitcomb in Aspen, Colorado, uses inexpensive homeopathics. He knows which one to use, gives it to the child, and whammo, the ear infections disappear and the pain goes.
Explain what you mean by homeopathics or homeopathy.
Homeopathics have been around for 200 years. Hahnemann discovered them in Germany. And what they do is they take poison and disease, and they reduce it down where there's hardly anything in the liquid. It's succussed. It's diluted upon dilution upon dilution. It works on the basis of physics. That's why mainstream medicine doesn't understand it. But to give you an idea of how effective it is and why the royal family in England uses it, in 1880, there was a cholera epidemic. The hospitals that used homeopathics had an 80% survival. The ones that did not had an 80% death rate. And that's why, to this day, the royal family is very much into homeopathics. Why, there's companies that make cold and flu remedies that are sold over-the-counter, $50 million a year, for cold and flu, oxacoxacillium, I think they call it. You can buy it in almost every drugstore in the United States. Amazingly effective, inexpensive, yet it flies in the face of the pharmaceutical industries who have an enormous amount of money to give to political campaigns, and therefore every legislation is biased against natural medicine. So we, as public, are going to have to become politically effective to make a change, demand that we have freedom of choice in medicine.
Well, certainly when we're talking about HMOs, and many people, if they're lucky and they have insurance, they're part of some kind of managed care system, we find that there's very little that is covered in terms of alternative medicine.
It's changing. Just last week, the Wall Street Journal had Oxford, the largest HMO in the United States, $88 billion a year. They have just decided to put alternative medicine, acupuncture, massage, and certain therapies on. The reason is the owner of the company uses it himself. He knows that they can save money, and he knows they're effective, and the public wants it. Do you know that 40% of the American public is using some form of it? In 1990, Harvard did a study. It was 34%. It's escalating. People know that they must take care of themselves and start taking responsibility for their own health. So the ice is melting, the world is changing, and it'll take a few more years, but what it really takes is your participation and your knowledge. Knowledge is power, and not only to save your own family's health as caregivers, but to make a change politically.
You just mentioned colds and flus, and we're coming into winter. I know it's hard to believe for people that are just amazed still that we are not in summer anymore. But colds and flus, what are alternative approaches, or are they just inevitable?
No. They are not inevitable. Think of your, you see, your body doesn't want to be ill. God gave you an immune system. And think of the immune system as a camel. You put one straw on top of the other, and finally, the final straw, it goes to its knees. It malfunctions. To get well, you've got to put one straw off at a time. In colds and flu, I have a chapter in the book on it, and we have Gary Gordon, an MD from Tempe, Arizona, and it's using vitamin C in huge quantities, vitamin A, and garlic. And if you do this within the first 6 hours, you can abort the cold and flu. We also have another chapter on oxygen therapy where you have ozone and hydrogen peroxide, intravenous hydrogen peroxide. You can treat 50 people for $9. That's why they don't want you to use it. It'll knock out a cold in one shot. In 1 hour, you can get rid of it. So you entertainers who need to perform, this is amazing. But you need a doctor for that. In the book on cold and flu, Gary Gordon says try vitamin C in huge quantities. That's for a 150-pound person, 2,000 an hour until you have loose bowels. Vitamin A, for a limited period of time, because it can be toxic, Dr. Gordon said, use 400,000 units of vitamin A. Not beta-carotene, because it needs to be synthesized in the liver, and it'll tax the liver. So, and then garlic. I use chiolic because there's no odor. It's an antibiotic. 10 capsules 3 times a day. Now remember, that's for a 150-pound person. If you are 100 pounds, you'd cut it in a third. Does it work? It is amazing. Tom Wood down in Miami, Florida, a friend of mine, took a flu shot, and he's in his 60s, and he was in bed for 2 weeks. I told him about it. He tried it, and within a day, he was up. But if you do this within the first 6 hours, you can abort the cold and flu. Think of your immune system, empower it with nutrition, and God's immune system will do the job.
Again, we're talking to Burton Goldberg, who has compiled this more than 1,000-page book called Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide. Now, I know a lot of people suffer from back pain and also arthritis. Talk a little about some of the therapies that you stress in the book.
Well, for back pain, I used to have back pain. I was seriously flat on my back 3 or 4 times a year until one of the physicians gave me a treatment of Rolfing. And that was where they restructure the body. My shoulder was higher on one side than the other. My head was too far forward, putting 25 pounds on my sacroiliac. And I was standing on the balls of my feet rather than flat. And I was a mess. And he restructured it. The body is malleable. And under body work, we cover back pain. Arthritis, glucosamine sulfate, some things you can get in the health food store. We have the sea cucumber from Australia. We have a cactus from the deserts of Northern California, shark cartilage, and allergies. Now listen to this. So many arthritic patients suffer from an allergy to nightshades, and those are tobacco, tomato, potato, eggplant, and pepper. So many people will get rid of it if they can stay away from those nightshades. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. That really is.
Also, your dental plays a role. In my book, I had a gentleman read the book, Roger Smith from Virginia, a sculptor. He had excruciating pains in his thumb. And in the book, Hal Huggins, a dentist in Colorado Springs, Colorado, said, try your amalgams. Your amalgams may cause it. You know, amalgams are nothing but 50% mercury. Now, if a child breaks a thermometer, we go crazy. And yet our dentists are putting this amalgam, this silver filling, this 50% mercury in our mouth. And the EPA will not allow them to bury that material in a toxic dump. As a matter of fact, the dentist is told before he goes to medical, while he's in medical school, don't touch it. You must keep it in a biohazardous container. Does it make sense that they put it in your mouth? They're also told not to touch it, to use a rubber glove. This gentleman removed his amalgams, and within 5 weeks, his arthritic pains disappeared. But you got to know how to remove them, because you can't remove them standardly. You must use a dam. Usually the dentist wears a gas mask because it turns into a methylmercury, which is 100 times more toxic. We're living in a toxic world. You certainly don't want to have toxin in your mouth, so don't let yourself and your children have mercury put in your mouth.
You know, I had read about that years ago, and when I had some fillings that I needed put in or refills, I did avoid using mercury because I was afraid. I have to say, I asked my dentist, and he said, "There's no mercury in there." I said, "What do you mean?" "But the silver fillings are filled with mercury." And he just didn't know. But what are the alternatives, Burton Goldberg?
Well, there's all kinds of plastics and enamels and new materials that you can put in. But isn't it amazing how ignorant some of these dentists are? And there are studies in medical journals that absolutely unequivocally prove the University of Calgary in Canada and the University of Georgia have done studies that there's no contest. It leaches from the mouth and goes into the body.
A lot. Burton Goldberg, editor of Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. According to the Washington Post, the Clinton re-election campaign has placed some ads on Christian radio stations that boast of his opposition to gay and lesbian marriage. Clinton is lucky this news didn't come out a few days ago, when hundreds of thousands of lesbians and gay men and their families were in Washington, D.C. to see the complete AIDS memorial quilt. On Saturday night, thousands walked through the streets of the nation's capital for a powerful candlelight vigil to remember the dead and fight like hell for those living with HIV or AIDS. The vigil did not pass by the White House. The only major act of protest this weekend was by ACT UP, which held a funeral procession and scattered ashes of the dead on the White House lawn to protest presidential inaction on AIDS. Clinton has blocked a national needle exchange program, and he never instituted the Manhattan Project he promised in order to find a cure. President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al, and Tipper Gore did, however, visit the AIDS memorial quilt on display on the Mall. The weekend's events in Washington kicked off on Friday, also known as National Coming Out Day. On Friday, the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay and lesbian membership organization, held a rally to get out the vote. HRC is trying to get the vote out for President Clinton, even though his record on gay and lesbian issues has been inconsistent. Elizabeth Birch is the executive director of the HRC.
Today we culminate a year's journey to educate America about the importance of coming out, getting involved, registering, and voting. Make no mistake, this election is so critical. We will quite literally be voting about our lives and for our lives in this election year. Each and every one of us, not just gay, straight, bisexual, transgendered, but our very important straight allies, organizations, coalition partners, every single person must make their voice heard this year. I want to tell you, coming to Washington from Northern California and dealing with the 104th Congress has often felt like playing master chess underwater in a toxic swamp. Nobody remembers better than the AIDS community what the Reagan-Bush years felt like. It wasn't even about not being heard. We were literally all outside of a brick wall, and we were left to rage. The Clinton administration has done a great deal, but President Clinton needed to be educated by a variety of people. One of the people that educated him most was Bob Hattori. And we remember Bob's eloquent voice speaking to this nation at the 1992 Democratic National Convention. What you should also know, he is one of the funniest people I have ever met. He is the one that said, it takes the village people to raise a child. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Hattori.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you all for being here. I just came back to hang out, and they said, do you mind speaking? And I thought, okay, fine. I just want to first of all announce that the President and the First Lady just went to the Quilt, and they toured, and I think if they... thank you. I think, oh my God, I'll just have these on. I think if they were touched the way we all were this morning and this afternoon, they'll know what a profound moment this weekend is for all of us. I think that it's important to say a few things, first of all, about Coming Out Day. I just think if I came out any further, I'd have to put on the Cher wig back there and sing. But more importantly, I think this weekend's gonna be filled with a lot of mixed emotions. Somehow it's gone from sort of a spiritual moment in the Quilt to like a circuit party, and it's all happening the same weekend. But more importantly, I think we have to transfer this energy that we're feeling here this weekend, this outpouring of support that we feel for each other towards the election. I think that I wasn't expecting to be here this election. 4 years ago when I stood with Elizabeth Glaser at the Democratic National Convention, I was undergoing chemotherapy. I thought I was a dead person. And I was living a life as a very self-indulgent dying diva. You know, everything had to be fabulous. And now that I'm alive, I have to pay my American Express bill and pay my friends back and file my IRS and, you know, get a new boyfriend and go to the gym again and go on a diet. And this long-term survival is a pain in the ass. But the real important thing is I want to thank all of you because you're one of the reasons myself and so many people living with AIDS are alive today. The amount of work I've seen people do in the AIDS community, in the gay and lesbian community, caring for each other in, you know, Tampa and in Portland and in Seattle and in Syracuse and in Buffalo is the most amazing example of family values that I could ever experience for anybody. And I want to say that that I feel like I'm alive today because of all of you, and I want to thank you for that. And more importantly, I want to say one thing about this election. A lot of people say, you know, apathy is what's impacting our community. But it's easy not to be apathetic when your life is at stake. And my life is at stake, and so is yours, both as gay and lesbian people, as women, as people who care about choice, people who care about the environment, people living with HIV and AIDS. This election is about life. This election is about the future, even and envisioning yourself as part of it and taking part in this election. And I want to say for those who want to stay home in your towns, tell them that voting is not a hot date in the town, and voting is not a reward, but voting is a strategy for survival. And I do a lot of things to survive this damn disease. I laugh, I cry, I talk, I take medicines, and sometimes the medicines make me nauseous, and sometimes politics makes me sick, but I still vote, and I think we all still should. So I want to say that if you believe that we're going to get the medicines we need, and if you believe we're going to get the legislation we need with the right-wing Congress or with Bob Dole or with Ralph Nader or with Ross Perot, I think you're politically delusional. I think that Bill Clinton cares profoundly about people with AIDS, and I think through Bill Clinton and through the work all of you have accomplished and will continue to accomplish, we'll be alive into the next century. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
I know I'm biased, and every executive director says this, but I have fallen completely in love with the staff of the Human Rights Campaign. One of the people that brings me to work every day is Daniel Zingali, our political director. He is brilliant, he is strategic. I think he's literally a gift from God to our community. He has helped to deliver the results that I referred to a short while ago. Ladies and gentlemen, HRC's political director, Daniel Cingali.
Thank you. All right. I went to see that movie Independence Day, and there's this scene in that movie where they blow up the nation's capital. And as someone who spends a lot of time in that building, I was a little bit alarmed by the fact that so many people in the audience were cheering when that happened. But my partner, who was sitting next to me, was even more alarmed by the fact that I was cheering more loudly than anybody in the theater. It was a very rough Congress. And it taught us something about this election that's coming up. For anyone who cares about AIDS, for anyone who cares about whether this country is going to be divided against itself or brought together, the stakes in this election are high and the contrasts are stark. There's been a lot of talk in this election about a bridge to the past versus a bridge to the future. Well, many Americans know all too well where a bridge to the past might lead: intimidation and ignorance and intolerance. And if anybody has any doubts at this point, this group of Americans is not getting on any bridge that leads to that past. Our future is built on American values like respect and fairness and honesty, including lesbian and gay people being honest about who we are. Some members of Congress justified their votes against fairness in this Congress on the ridiculous suggestion that they don't have any lesbian or gay constituents in their part of the country. Well, let me tell you, today, all over this country, those candidates for re-election are discovering that their gay and lesbian constituents are not only coming out, they're coming out and filling the phone banks, walking the precincts, and mobilizing our family and friends to turn them out of office and elect people who have a clue. Our next speaker has recently written a book, and the title of that book, I think, best describes what happens to each of us when we come out. That very act becomes something political in this country. Just by being honest about who you are, we are all accidental activists in our own way, helping to change the dialogue in this country about what is right and what is fair. What I want you all to know is that Candace is to the Human Rights Campaign what rocket fuel is to NASA. No fear, just integrity and strength and energy reserves that appear to never run out. She has crisscrossed this country for a second year in a row, literally touching thousands of lives and giving a message of honesty and hope. Please join me in welcoming HRC's favorite accidental activist, Candace Gingrich.
Thank you. Daniel claimed that he was going to introduce me as the biggest goofball on his hall, but he didn't do that, so it's true anyhow. I could never imagine standing in front of hundreds of people in our nation's capital talking to them about coming out. But here I am. And I don't know what aspects of the story you know, my coming out stories. I have a couple of them. But long ago in 1987, when I came out to myself and consequently came out to my family, involuntarily, but it came out to my family. At that time, my brother was already a member of Congress, a Republican member of Congress. And so just as I was concerned how every member of the family would react, I was also extra concerned about his. And his response at this time, 1987, to me, was that it was my life and I had the right to live it the way that I wanted to. And at the age of 21, I thought that sounded like a pretty good deal. I didn't know any better. I chose for the next seven, eight years to remain blissfully ignorant, apathetic, complacent. I wasn't aware of what was going on in our country. I didn't realize that people could be fired because they're gay. I didn't realize that our youth were dying, committing suicide, attempting suicide, running away from home, dropping out of school at higher rates than other students because of their orientation. And I certainly didn't realize that the people that we were putting in office didn't care about us. 1994 happened, and in the residual effects after the election, after my brother was the Speaker of the House, in an interview, I had a reporter ask me if I was gay. She made some presumptions about my appearance. I'm not sure what she's talking about. And at the time, I thought to myself, I have no reason to lie to this woman. I'm not ashamed of who I am. I am proud. I am happy. And I told her the truth. I figured, at the very least, my family wouldn't have expected me to lie or to avoid the question. And so I came out to an Associated Press reporter. Not some hometown newspaper or anything, you know. And everything was fine, you know, nothing really happened. The family was okay about it, and I was okay, and I was still pretty much blissfully ignorant until Thanksgiving dinner. And Newt wasn't there, Newt and his wife weren't there, but the rest of the family was, my two sisters, their family, mom and dad. And just innocently, casual conversation, my sister Roberta said to me, did you read or hear about what Newt has to say about gay people? You know, that you should be tolerated. No, I hadn't heard that. Would you like to share the rest of it? And she did, and explained to me the infamous statement that gays should not be celebrated or demonized, but we should be tolerated. You know, like our society tolerates alcoholics. Well, I'm glad I didn't have any food in my mouth. I couldn't speak for the rest of the dinner, and found out soon enough that that was just the tip of the iceberg. That not only had my brother had a zero voting record on gay and lesbian issues, he couldn't even vote to include sexual orientation in the Hate Crime Statistics Act back in 87. That was just the tip of the iceberg. And for me, that was the extra, my own rocket fuel to come out and be out and open and active. I couldn't take it anymore, so to speak. And in all of my travels, I have found out that yes, we are accidental activists, but in reality, we're reactivists. That it takes some defining moment in our life, some catalyst, some event, for us to realize that there is a need for us to be out and active. This year is it. This year is your year, if you're not already, to come out, make your voice heard at the ballot box, in the campaign offices, all over our country, to send a loud message that we do not, this is not a country where groups of people are regularly scapegoated or demonized just to score political points. This isn't a country where if you belong to a particular group, whether it be immigrants or welfare mothers or people with HIV and AIDS or gay or lesbian people, that you're not here just to be kicked around. Looking back over the past 2 years, the 104th Congress, I think we've seen a number of people who don't care about us. I think it's pretty obvious. The debate over the Defense of Marriage Act. If you're a living, breathing human, I don't think that you could not have been moved by the words hurled on the very House floor. So that this year, if you haven't realized it before, the importance of coming out, because we know it is the single most powerful, important thing that you can do to change the ignorance that people have about us into understanding. But to come out voting this year, because literally our lives depend on it. Now, I don't have any fancy charts or anything. I have my own arms to show you this graphic. And I would thank my girlfriend, Chris Pratt, for showing me this graphic before. But if this is America, this is the number of people who are registered to vote out of this. And this is the number of people who actually take the time to vote. That's not how America is supposed to be run. When you look at 94, only 39% of us took the time to come out and vote. We cannot let that happen again. So I hope that November 5th, it's a leap year or something. All right, I'll be blamed for all the people at the ballot boxes on Monday now, all right. I hope that you will join me on November 5th, out, open, proud, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, gay-friendly, parent, neighbor, co-worker, as MLK said, to march on those ballot boxes and take back our country and bring it back to the hands of the people who care about all Americans. Thank you.
Candace Gingrich is the half-sister of House Speaker Newt Gingrich. She's on the staff of the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay rights group. She spoke Friday in Washington for National Coming Out Day. And you're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In recent years, fewer and fewer people have been turning out at the polls, perhaps because they feel as if their vote doesn't matter, perhaps because the candidates they like most don't stand a chance against a wealthy opponent. Well, there are efforts underway nationwide in this election year to reform the electoral system in order to increase the numbers of people voting and to increase the diversity of voices in the political system. One of those efforts concerns proportional representation, a system widely used in various European countries in which voters get to rank the candidates. In its biggest test to date, a form of proportional representation called preference voting will be on the ballot in San Francisco this November. Joining Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky to discuss the preference voting option, known as Measure H, are three political activists who worked to get it on the San Francisco ballot. Former police commissioner Gwen Craig chaired the task force that got the measure drafted and approved. Ruth Picone is a judicial investigator and a member of the California Latino Civil Rights Network. And Howard Wallace is a union organizer and longtime Bay Area gay activist.
In San Francisco, one of the most liberal cities, at least by reputation, in the country, on our local governing body called the Board of Supervisors, which listeners around the country should realize is the equivalent of a city council, we already have a very diverse body. We have six women and five men, I believe. We have three Asian Americans, three lesbians or gays, an African American, a Latino. What reform is necessary in this in order to bring more people to the table? It would look pretty good to people in the rest of the country.
The diversity that's come about on our Board of Supervisors has largely been kind of leftovers of when we had district elections in San Francisco and come about through various mayoral appointments that have happened. In fact, we've only had one person of color who was elected to the Board of Supervisors in her own right under the current at-large system without benefit of mayoral appointment. By and large, the minority members, those who belong to minority communities who are on the Board of Supervisors, have come about either as having been first elected to the board through district system or having been appointed by one of the mayors that we've had. So we're looking for something that will put that power to ensure diversity back into the hands of the actual voters.
And how would proportional representation do that, Ruth Picone?
Proportional representation, the way we're looking at it, is that it would encourage a more diverse crowd of people, especially people that come from the grassroots communities, to run for office, to even think of running for office, because it would bring the cost down. And, you know, we feel that that would definitely give us a better pool of candidates and that there would also be more accountability because of that.
Now, Howard Rollis, you have run for citywide office, so you know what the drill is like. How would Proposition H change that? Do you think you would have won, by the way, if Proposition H and proportional representation had been in effect?
I'm not sure. There were a lot of elements involved when I ran, but I think it will tend to encourage a lot of people who are staying away from the polls today who would augment progressive forces in the election because they're not wasting their vote. And I think people are tired of a lesser evil and tired of feeling that, the candidate I prefer the most, I don't dare vote for them because I'll be wasting my vote and then, somebody much, much worse will get in. If your first choice doesn't make it, your second choice, the vote will carry over to your second choice. So you can really vote your first choice and that person has the momentum built up too. So it encourages something. Instead of having the newspapers say, well, so-and-so is in the second tier, so they don't have a chance, and everybody sort of gravitates their radar a little bit lower, and their expectations are lower. We need to have higher expectations and fight for things we really believe in.
Gwen Craig, you mentioned in passing campaign finance and spending, and certainly those of us who follow elections closely are dismayed, disgusted, and sometimes depressed by the fact that it costs so much money to run for office, just about any office. Here in San Francisco, to win a citywide election on the Board of Supervisors, it's generally considered you have to raise at least $250,000, although some people have done it with less. Some have raised more and lost. But $250,000 seems to be the base benchmark. That's a heck of a lot of money to raise at bake sales or neighborhood door-to-door canvassing.
It is a lot of money, and you find that a lot of candidates tailor their message and tailor their positions to try and attract the kind of money that they need and stay away from going to sections of the city or sections of the electorate that they think can't really put the kind of finances behind them that they need. So we find that money drives the kind of board that we get so much and the influence of the money that candidates do get, that has a lot to do with what becomes of them once they're elected to the board.
Yeah, but how would this change that? How would proportional voting take the money out? Wouldn't somebody who wants to win, say, and needs fewer votes proportionally, just be maybe spending more money to chase those fewer votes?
Well, it's possible, and we found the same thing when we had district elections. Some people went ahead and raised the same amount of money that people have been raising under the at-large system and just glutted their district with the mailers and all that their money could buy. But generally, what it makes possible is that people can raise less money and still win a seat because it brings down, with the formula that's used, it brings down the number of votes that you need to be elected. And so candidates can target their votes, target their pitch to the various communities they want to reach or the neighborhoods they want to reach. Wherever they want to get that number of votes from, they can do that. And they don't necessarily have to be able to saturate the city with mailers and commercials, and they can run a campaign that will cost them a lot less money because they have a lot less votes that will get them a seat.
Ruth Picon, here in California, Latinos are kind of the sleeping giant of electoral politics. Enormous numbers in communities like Los Angeles, but also, of course, here in San Francisco. And the most underrepresented at the polls. I think the last statistics I saw for 1994 was that eligible Latinos constituted 26% of the state's population, but just 7% of the voters. How would proportional representation change that playing field for Latinos?
Well, I think that when people see that candidates from their community are running because people feel that they have a better chance of running, then they're encouraged, motivated to get out and vote. I think that for getting the Latino community to go out and vote, that when we've seen community candidates running for office, you know, whether it's Board of Education or community college, it does increase Latinos getting out to vote because registering people to vote is just part of the battle. The other part is motivating them to get out and vote.
So why do you think proportionally you would say, well, your vote, you have, instead of just voting once, you're going to rank 11 people here. What's motivating? What's enabling? What's empowering about telling people that?
Just being able to, you know, get people to understand that with preferential voting, their votes aren't wasted. And I think when people feel that a system is more fair, then they are more apt to get out and vote. When people feel that the system is not fair because their candidates are not able to really run or you know, they're not the ones they want to run, their candidates don't win, that, you know, creates and encourages voter apathy and cynicism. So I think that, you know, preference, when people see that it does create a fair system, that will motivate people, more people to vote when they see that we are getting better results year after year.
Gwen Craig?
What we have right now is people trying to vote smart and either withholding their vote from candidates who they see as either not having a chance at all or being so popular that they don't really need their vote, so they'll put it on someone else. I think preference voting gives them a chance to do this without going through those kind of mechanisms. If their candidate has an excess of votes or doesn't have enough vote to place, then that vote transfers means they can really vote for who they like. And the other thing that happens is that, particularly among minority communities, you find candidates canceling themselves out or not running at all because there's the thinking that if more than one candidate is running from a underrepresented population, then they might both lose because the community will be split. Under this system, I think we can help people to understand that candidates of any number can run, and those who have the strength will win. People can still vote their choices, and by that transfer of votes that happen, then those who have the most strength throughout the electorate will be elected, and you don't have to worry about those votes hurting one candidate or the other.
Howard Wallace, here on the local level in San Francisco, as well as on the national level, we see the same kind of people elected to office over and over again. They're lawyers. They're university graduates, they're professionals, they're wealthy people, they represent the elite of the United States. You don't see very many bus drivers, you don't see very many nurses, you don't see very many teachers, for that matter, elected to office. Do you think it would help the class division that we basically have and who gets elected to office to have proportional representation, to have more working class people elected?
Absolutely, because I think it would reduce the cost per vote, for one thing. All the other things that we do in elections are still going to be necessary in terms of coalition building, fundraising. We'll still have to do it. But it'll, as Gwen was saying, the strategizing is sort of built into the process, and we can augment that strategy. You know, we've already got the preferences built in, so we're going to gain in that respect. I think one thing that would flow if we get preferential voting here from the process is to start rating our politicians. And we don't do that very effectively in a lot of areas in the country. National AFL-CIO and now some groups have national ratings, but we don't do it enough on a local level of how people actually voted on the hot issues during the year. And I think one of the things we need to build into the process along with proportional representation is conferences and conventions where the various movements come together and say, what are our bottom lines for each movement? And let's stick together around those bottom lines and make that the acid test for each politician that's running.
In this election year, there's been a lot of discontent with the two-party system. Democrats and Republicans. We don't really have a two-party system in San Francisco. It's been 16 years since an out-front Republican was elected to the Board of Supervisors. But do you see that a proportional representation would help third parties or fourth parties, would help a Green Party or a Labor Party, or if there were one, an African-American political party, get started and implant itself?
Well, it certainly seems like it, and I can tell you that a lot of the support that we've picked up have been from activists in those so-called third parties. The Green Party has been a large part of the core of our support, the Peace and Freedom Party here. And so I think that what we see is that as the numbers in the population of those people who register in those various parties goes up, and if people are willing to vote that way as they make their choices, if they base them pretty much on party party line by and large, then you'll see the proportion that they represent in the electorate be the proportion of seats that are won on the board. So it should work out to give those, again, minority constituencies a better chance of winning seats. And I think for that reason, we might see even more variety on the board in terms of ideology as well as the other kind of diversity that we look for.
25 years or so ago, when I lived in San Francisco, a number of us came together and worked in something called Citizens for Representative Government, which was the precursor to getting district elections for supervisors passed. And we did get it passed after many years of struggle. Then it was revoked by the voters several years later, partially because of the tragedy of the assassinations of the mayor of San Francisco and Supervisor Harvey Milk, two liberals, by a man who'd been elected as a conservative, a former firefighter and policeman. What's wrong with district elections? Why shouldn't we have people elected by district rather than proportionally citywide in a place like San Francisco so that they can represent, be responsible to a smaller neighborhood and a smaller community? Howard?
I think there's no panacea in terms of the perfect process for electing people, but districts is something I was helped champion along with, I think, everybody else here at one time or another to help get a breakthrough. You know, and Lonnie Guinier has talked about cumulative voting, which would give you a kind of breakthrough in some southern states where there's systematic denial of opportunities for African Americans. Or any minority in any city where there, it's systematic. But we've, I think, accomplished some of that breakthrough now ethnically and sexual orientation and in terms of women in the city. What we need now, I think, is to give some economic and political character to the election, and I think this will do that. And there are problems in drawing lines. It's very hard to draw lines that really serve the interests of minorities and at the same time don't butt up against the new Supreme Court decisions, which are making it more and more difficult to do anything that can even hint at gerrymandering. I think this has some of the best qualities of traits of the districts without some of the pitfalls of the districts.
Ruth Picon, when we did have district elections here in San Francisco, we tried to draw, those of us involved in it, a district that would elect a Latino. And a Latino was not elected from that district. Cal Ruth Silver, a Caucasian woman, was elected from that district. We failed then to do it. Wouldn't it be better now that Latinos are more organized and we're 20, 25 years later to have a district that would guarantee Latino representation?
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. But the problem is that now, 20 years later, Latinos are so dispersed throughout the city that we've looked at the precincts and where the higher populations of Latinos are, and you really can't draw a good district. The proposed district that is, you know, the one that's being proposed now, it has about a 50% population of Latinos, but the concern is that of that population, only about 30% are eligible to vote. So for Latinos, even I think back then, we would have done a lot better if we had had an option like at-large with preference, where it doesn't matter where you live, but people who have similar concerns and interests can vote for the candidate of their choice. So I view proportional representation as being a big improvement over district elections. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to get the voters to look at the pros and cons of each. Both are an improvement over the current system at large. But we need to really look at what are the strengths and weaknesses of each one, because I think at large with preference really does avoid the pitfalls like Howard was saying.
Ruth Picon, Howard Wallace, Gwen Craig, thank you very much for joining us on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Larry Bensky in San Francisco.
And Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, we take a look at the latest developments in the CIA Contra Crips drugs connection. You've been listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition.